The Spirit of God, like a fire, is burning. The latter day glory begins to come forth.
Project Zion Podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts the restoration offers for today's world. We aim to feature a wide variety of guests and panelists with roots in the restoration tradition from Community of Christ and our friends in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The music has been provided by Mark Abernethy. You can find his music at www.mark-abernethy.com.
Hello, I'm Seth Bryant, and this is Project Zion. I'm excited to have our two guests, John Hamer and Miles Fuller, here to discuss redefining faith within the Restoration. And we're actually recording before a live audience in the Salt Lake City Community of Christ, so this will be the one time that everyone can make some noise. You want to make some noise and show them I'm not lying? All right, great. So this is going to be an exploration of how believers might navigate restoration faith apart from institutional definitions and the way that faith is often defined culturally. And so for introductions, John Hamer, you have appeared on just about every podcast that has to do with this sort of subject. So I'm going to invite you to introduce yourself and maybe give us something new that you haven't shared previously, if that's possible.
All right. Well, thank you for having me on your podcast. I'm excited about this podcast, this project. I've heard about it a lot. Yes, I have been on a lot of other podcasts before, and so I have told my story a few times and to a few, to a few different panels, and so I'm just trying to think. So one of the things about me is, that I'm doing right now is that I'm, a pastor, which is, like yourself, or like Robin here is the, functionally it's the equivalent of a bishop in an LDS ward. Pastor in a Community of Christ congregation, the downtown congregation of the Church of Community of Christ in Toronto, and we are finishing up building a brand new building, and I'm really excited about it. It is two blocks away from where John Taylor was the very first pastor of the congregation back in 1834. And so it's right in the heart of the oldest part of the city of Toronto, and we are on the ground floor in a commercial condo in a brand new 20-story tower, multi-use tower. So it's in the best part of this, destination place in the city, and I'm really excited about it. So.
That is really exciting.
In terms of anything new to share, I was trying to think about this. So I mean, I've told people before in podcasts that I'm a huge Star Trek fan, and I'm actually launching my own podcast about how we can use, Star Trek, philosophy in order to explore gospel principles, So if you're excited about that, no.
I am incredibly excited about that, and I hope that we can have a conversation at some point, because that's awesome. So.
Actually, I'm not, but if you do have a podcast and you want to talk about it, I'm ready to talk about it, but I'm not launching my own.
Okay.
And that's, I'm sorry.
It was a major letdown.
Yeah,
I wanted it.
I know. After everybody wanted it so much, I'm like, yeah. Wait a second. No, yeah. I'm not.
You better cash that check.
And Miles Fuller is a good friend of mine. We have known each other for about a decade now. We went to school together at Westminster College here in Salt Lake City.
It was a middle school back then, yeah.
A very expensive middle school. So tell us a little bit about yourself, and I hope that you can weave in some of that story about your upbringing with Mormonism and also kind of the unique elements to it and how it's helped shape who you are today.
Okay, so I was born in Salt Lake City, and I have a multi-generational Latter-day Saint family from Restoration on both sides. But my parents are both painters and artists, and my father was a jazz musician, and that highly concentrated those endeavors of meaning have really impacted what I think that the experience of Restoration churches and Mormonism and the LDS Church specifically is, so that I might not be equipped to be fully empathetic because my my experience growing up with my parents was a shuffle between Miles Davis Kind of Blue and going to museums to find Rembrandts and then church services. And they all had equal meaning. So there was no way to say that that when we're in church or when we have family prayer or when we're scripture reading, that that's where we find meaning. And in some ways, my parents would kind of go on a roller coaster with the LDS church and their devotion because they caught some flack from friends and family and neighborhoods were there because at their heart they were kind of bohemian artists and they learned how to draw nudes in art school. They were really kind of a thorn in the side of a lot of wards. So the fact that we couldn't have Rembrandt without some figurative drawing and that tradition of art meant that if the LDS Church members were thinking that it was sinful for what they did, then we needed to supplement our Mormon experience with our experience in the arts. So that, I think, has carried through where I don't feel a disconnect between my religion. My religion has always been high art and Mormonism, and high art and Mormonism is so much more than just a faith community. For better or worse, it's a lot of structures. And so, even though I identify as a Salt Lake City Mormon, my life is probably pretty secular, and I teach creative writing and graphic literature, comic books at a university level. And that's because playing with language was even the step to go past my parents, and really, upset my community. I mean, from the beginning, the one thing you can't play with language. We're gonna keep all the words in these cliches, and these are the only ways you can talk, and these are the only ways you can write. And I immediately thought, okay, stand-up comedians and writers are the only identities that I don't see a lot in Mormonism, and those are the two things that I have done. So because language is so important to me, I sometimes ache for the limited language in a lot of Mormon discussions, but it's still essential to me. I'm a Salt Lake City Mormon. I can't depart from that. And when I met you at Westminster, we were working in a writing center. We were, you know, coaching people on their language. So, I mean, I think that sets the tone for a lot of things I've done since.
Great. Yeah, I'm so excited to have you guys here. And I wanted to start out our conversation with a story. And so just a few days ago, I was in Nauvoo, and I'm driving past the temple at night. And so if anyone here has been to Nauvoo at night and seen the temple and how it's lit up, I mean, it's absolutely gorgeous. And across the street is a guy in a lawn chair, and he's holding a sign, and the sign has LED lights in it, and there's only one message, and it's www.josephlied.com. And so I slow down, I roll down my window, and I so badly want to say something. And words absolutely fail me in this moment. And what's interesting, I can hear in the background that the Nauvoo pageant is going on. And the Nauvoo pageant, I mean, it's blaring until about 10 o'clock at night, the whole month of July in Nauvoo. I can hear it in the background, and I know that the message that it's sending is equally frustrating in some ways, because it's almost the exact opposite of the guy in the lawn chair, right? It's like Joseph only tells the truth or never lied. I talking with a friend, I think the one thing I should have said when I rolled down the window was, well, it's complicated. And so I want to explore that insistence of black and white thinking on both sides and what you might say to the guy holding the sign. Or on the reverse, I was asked by a older sister missionary in the LDS church after a tour of actually the John Taylor home, can you share your testimony of Joseph Smith? And I knew that what I shared was instantly going to be problematic because it was so nuanced. But so what's your testimony? What do you share in that moment? Or what do you with the LDS missionary? Or what do you share in that moment with the guy in the lawn chair holding the LED sign that says Joseph lied?
Nauvoo is really complicated place to do any of this kind of stuff. I mean, Nauvoo is one of these wonderful places that is totally contested space like that. And so obviously it has become way more LDS colonized. And so for a very particular kind of Orthodox Mormon who is especially there with their family on a pilgrimage for very particular experiences that you're kind of going for. And so, like you say, the pageant, which is definitely has a, black and white picture, or actually, just a very, clear picture of there's Joseph can do no wrong. And then down to also all of the LDS guides, are really, as they're showing you any room, they're not so much telling you, about how people lived in that particular time period or that era, but I mean, there's almost always, it's connected to a faith story. So in this, so like the wood burning stove is a thing. So just in the same way that wood had to be stored and collected for this, so too God does this in our lives or something like that. And so it really becomes really stretched and crazy. And so it's actually hard to experience that for me, right. I find when I'm going around and doing that. How would I answer, her in terms of the, in terms of like, what's your testimony of Joseph Smith? I guess my inclination when I'm in those circumstances is to talk about, the broader heritage. And so I would say that one of the reasons why I actually came here is I kind of feel that we as a people, my ancestors lived here. My ancestors had their house just up the street. The Winchester Street is named after my great, 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 great grandparents here. That there were more people in this movement than just Joseph Smith. That, I am interested in the whole heritage of what my ancestors built and did. And obviously they were inspired by the message that Joseph Smith had, and the whole restoration tradition that they all formed together continues to inspire me. But I think that our focus is too much on Joseph Smith. She would be very uncomfortable with me saying that, but I guess that's my sense is too much that we focus so much on Joseph Smith that already is just a huge problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really agree. And I like that. We overemphasize a man instead of a movement. And there are a lot of gestures and a lot of family stories and a lot of possibilities for belief and really creative, if albeit impulsive and combative and misunderstood, members of the whole movement of the restoration. So to do that procrustean act and just eliminate everything but Joseph Smith is unfair to who we are now and who we've come from. I tend to like even the most, confused, or negative even stories surrounding the Prophet Joseph Smith, because I want to feel like I've come from a tradition of eccentricity. Like I am somehow okay and validated being as bizarre as I am because I come from this record of people who didn't know how to act, who were charismatic but really failing. And I love the idea of the early Mormon churches and congregations being this ragtag group of scamps that really couldn't inhabit an American landscape the way that other people wanted to. I mean, if you can go into a space where people are living like outlaws and are trying to resist the structures of the East Coast, and you somehow break their laws when they have no laws, you're doing something weird. And I love that. I love that you can travel west and upset people who have virtually no rules. And that's the legacy of our history of Mormonism. So I see,
It turns out they had rules.
Yeah,
we were just pretending that we don't have rules. There were our rules. We just
you crossed the line. We didn't know it until you came with all your Mormon behavior, misbehavior. And so when I think of Joseph Smith being a truth teller, or Joseph Smith being a liar, either is so oversimplified, and they sort of validate each other. I mean, if you have such a simple binary that Joseph Smith is either everything in the world to you, or he is your system for disbelief, then then where are all these other sources where you're going to find meaning? And what about what stems from the ideas he had? I mean, he's so, charismatic and articulate and functions in a bunch of different ways for different people in that history. So why do we have to accordion it down to, our little Harry Potter savior or the worst person that ever lived? I don't need, you need him to be a liar or a truth teller.
Right. And that really is a good segue for a question I wanted to ask you, Miles. So you've had, friends and others who have left the LDS Church are very angry and are angry that you're not angry. And, you know, for various things, fill in the blank, whether it's, blacks in the priesthood or polygamy or treatment of LGBT persons. And so my question for you is, how do you respond to them in saying that you're not upset and you're still claiming this identity? And it almost seems like in many ways you've said in conversations with me that, you're in love with the ugliness of it. Like, it's not warts and all. It's like, no, you love the warts. So, but how do you respond to them? How do you explain your journey to them and your identity to them?
Well, it might be partly evasive on my part because there are so many ways that the Mormon experience, has been formative to my identity, that trying to be surgical and excise all this and say, I'm done with this based on some faith tenets. I'm done with this. I want nothing to do with it. Seems impossible. There are too many integrated parts of my life that were formed only through a Mormon experience that was secular and economic and social and aesthetic and where we found meaning in really soaring spots. So I think I'd have to doubt myself too much to inhabit a space where I'm not also Mormon. And my lack of anger might come from the fact that I have been very lucky to have a buffer. I have been insulated from some of these direct binaries because I felt like I had a space to express myself. I felt like I had ways to articulate what I felt. One of the first interactions you had with me, you mentioned that the first time you saw me on our college campus, I was walking by with I was just another cross-dressing 20-year-old at a liberal arts college, and I was walking by with my purse, and I said something in a way that you were like, I hate that guy. Whoever that guy is, I hate that guy. And I loved inhabiting a space that where I was comfortable. I'm sure I was obnoxious. And then one of the next interactions you had with me was I told you, I think I'm going to, I was about 20, so I was just deciding late. I said, I think I'm going to go on an LDS mission or I'll become a Catholic priest. In the same sentence.
Right.
And it was exactly in the same space, in my headspace, is that you make these choices that are about intensity. They're about devotion. They're about finding meaning and risking and investing yourself in something. It doesn't matter what it is. And so if I say I want to, I heard a lot of narratives from counterculture as you become a young adult in Salt Lake City that, was like, I'm not sure if I have a testimony. And then 2 weeks later, that friend would be doing lines of cocaine off a urinal in some public bathroom. I think that transition, we create these false dichotomies. And I would just wanted to keep as much of my experience as possible. So anyone who is angsty about the sort of betrayal or the sense of I didn't have the truth that I thought I had in the Mormon experience, I really ache for, and I know that I'm not equipped to fully empathize because I have been able to find meaning in other ways. And that was sort of the challenge from birth with my parents, is that you find meaning through the Mormon cosmology, but also it doesn't account for everything. And once it's accounted for everything, I think it's really easy to be hurt by it.
And so that's really interesting because it brings up the question, and I'm going to pose this to John first. In what ways do you see former or disaffected Mormons still working within the parameters of Mormonism, frustrated at the very definitions that they haven't really given up?
Well, so if I can step back for the question you had previously for Miles. So when you were talking about the experience that people had where they're very angry or they're very hurt and they have just a lot of pain and all of those kind of things, and I think Miles said this well, which is that there's no way because everyone has had different experiences, in no way should anybody minimize or discount or say in any way that any of those experiences aren't valid or that those feelings aren't real or there shouldn't be had, or that, because all of those things are very valid responses to a person's individual path and upbringing in a pretty extreme place like Utah here in some ways. You know, this dichotomy of the straight and narrow path or the extreme out of it example you had in the cocaine. So, I'm not sure.
That's a real story.
Okay. Anyway, I don't mean, but in terms of that though, so for example, I talk a lot to every kind of one of the different podcasts. So I'm on, podcasts that are much more, inside into the LDS, Orthodox circle, let's say, if I'm on like a Sunday school podcast, just talking about scriptures or something like that, to ones that are way more borderlands, where Mormon Stories has been, to Mormon Expression, to Mormon Expositor, to, you know, way out there on Infants on Thrones, the different audiences of outside of the borderlands or past the borderlands or wherever. And I do find that within that spectrum, one things that we don't, think about often is how much we have a framework for the way we are thinking about things. So, because you were raised within a Mormon framework, that is specifically a black and white framework where everything, is exactly true in a very literalistic way. And then you might get to a place where you are, encounter problems with that narrative that you've had for whatever reason you encounter those. They can be anything. Either a truth claim problem or something that's actually hurtful in a social way or any other thing that can have happened that caused that disconnect, then there is a very ready narrative that also exists that has been built now over the past couple decades and is very strong of the ex-Mormon narrative, which that narrative is through reasoned exploration, you have been able to intellectually deconstruct the original faith claims. And so the point where now you've achieved that, the truth, right? And so in some ways, this framework though is still very inherently Mormon because at the end of the day, you still are the one with the truth, right? And so, right. And I think it's not always, understood that way, you know, in other words, as being that in one case it was a narrative and now you have a new narrative and we frame everything and we think through narratives, those kind of ways, but there may well be, it may well be that truth isn't a simple thing to have. There is actual empirical data and things like that. There are claims that can be invalidated, all those kind of things. But but when we're talking about like deeper meaning to life and what it means to, live life meaningfully, to be human, to all these other kinds of things, there may well be more thinking that can be done. And that's maybe something that one of the things I try to poke some people in the borderlands about when I'm talking to different people on the podcast.
And so when somebody is in that place of pain and perhaps they're inclined to just swap one form of the absolute truth for another form of it, so you're problematizing and trying to help them to see things in a much more complicated manner. But how do you know, what advice, and maybe this goes, Miles, to your earlier comment about counterculture, how do you help someone not go from I'm doubting my faith to I'm committing, you know, I'm doing something that's really, you know, amoral? So in that moment of doubting, questioning, you know, what grounding should or could a person seek out as they're trying to hold on to maybe their faith or hold on to something and not completely go into what's been called a second adolescence. But in many cases for Mormons, there hasn't been a full adolescence anyway in the first place. But without, you know, being pulled into the gravity of this second adolescence and just going off the deep end.
Well, I think that's tough when you have such a dominant culture that's comprehensive and it affects your professional and your academic and your interpersonal and your family relationships, that it's easy to just be on the same conveyor belt. And so counterculture in Utah, at least, upholds the mainstream by announcing how it's not part of it directly. So you have to go checklist against the rules and the truth claims and the lifestyle practices a lot of the mainstream culture in order to say, I'm not one of the club. Look at my face tattoo. I promise that I don't go to church anymore. Like that kind of, it seems like a lot of work. And so one easy response is do what you like, but you're not going to like extremes if you come from an extreme. If you're uncomfortable in one extreme and you go to another, you're going to be uncomfortable. There are very small stages that you find what you believe and what you prefer. A linchpin thing in Utah is coffee, is drinking coffee when there's a mainstream dominant LDS culture that resists it. Adults or young adults starting to drink coffee to announce that they are not participating in a religious cosmology, not necessarily, it's not even a major part of the church. You find that my body can't handle coffee. Coffee makes me nervous, jittery, and gives me diarrhea. And now that's incorporated into my life, and I'm supposed to like it because it announces that I no longer believe in this. And those are the gestures that I think that make me sad, but they're part of the growing pains. You can't see how bizarre and how bizarre your thinking is and how you mishandle what's available to you beyond the most simplified, at least LDS Mormon experience or other Restoration Church experience, until you interact in a more secular way. And I think one way to take comfort is that the rest of the United States and the world do not think we're special, other than being a little bizarre, a little eccentric. They do not want to discuss the same things we're discussing. So you can take some relief that you don't have to fight the good fight because it's irrelevant to a lot of the human experience. And that's how I find a lot of comfort in thinking that my Mormonism is at best a party trick. You know, it's something to bring up and seem a little more, ooh, that's exotic. He comes from from Salt Lake City. But it doesn't have to change my neuroscience every day.
So it's really interesting. I was in a coffee shop in Utah, and then a day later, I was in one in California, and I was struck by the fact in California that there were children in there with their parents getting coffee. And in Utah, it was like you had gone in a bar. You know, I'm surprised they didn't card me before I went in. It was a totally different feel. And I saw these kids inside of this coffee shop in California, and I almost thought, what are these parents doing bringing these kids in here? Because I'm falling back in this old mindset of how I grew up. And then it instantly dawned on me, like, no, this is actually normal. But yeah, so when your anti-conformity is always 180 degrees from the things the thing you claim to despise, it's really not anti-conformity, it's just reverse conformity. I mean, it's just very interesting to see the weird sorts of things that take place in Utah. John, you mentioned how Nauvoo is a strange place, a contested place, and Utah certainly, you know, is a very odd space as well. And having lived away for 10 years and then moving back just last year, I'm constantly struck by just how weird a space Utah can be.
I had to very deliberately teach myself to like coffee when I was an 18-year-old and decided I'm not going to be a Mormon anymore. And so, I mean, I went out with a friend of mine, and we just every night we would go to a coffee, you know, like go to Denny's or something like that, and I was trying to drink Denny's coffee, which is probably a problem right there. Right. Upon reflection, I now know. But anyway, and so anyway, I didn't like it at all for whatever, 6 months, but now I absolutely love coffee. So anyway,
right.
So it's something. But, and so as a boundary marker, that's probably not a very particularly problematic one. And I also don't think that a lot of the delayed adolescence doesn't have to be a problem. I mean, a friend of mine has become addicted to vaping cigarettes for some reason as an adult, and I think that's a little crazy. But anyway, you know, in other words, you don't have to have picked up all of these particular things, you know, but I mean, there's some things that you could do that, anyway.
So. Yeah, I've heard of people who will only try something that goes against their former moral framework, only try one new thing a week or a month, just slowly enter into it, you know, rather than just going completely nuts, as sometimes you see. So one thing that a lot of times is, as people are questioning their faith or having issues, they will toy with the idea of what I'll call cafeteria Mormonism, or simply saying, you know, we're going to go to church once, twice a month, but we're going to do this, and we're only going to believe this and not that. And so I myself had that a similar thought. But I guess the more that I reflect on it, I wonder if that's really healthy, or if doing the really hard work of redefining things for yourself, tends to be a much healthier way of approaching it, rather than just selectively saying, well, I'm still going to work within the boundaries, but, or the parameters of the discussion, but I'm only going to select, you know, A, C, and F, and not the entire thing. So I guess my question would be, how can people navigate, as people are trying to navigate and redefine faith for themselves, identity for themselves, there's going to be pushback from the community. And so I'm wondering how people can navigate in the midst of that pushback, wanting to claim a corporate identity when the body doesn't always want to claim you if you don't exactly look the same.
I think it's a natural response to want to participate as much as you can handle while you're questioning things. But, I think it's treacherous in the LDS Church and perhaps a lot of congregations of many different religious contexts, because so much of your life is dependent on appearance. I mean, it goes back to, some sort of, Protestant predestinations. You show you're faithful by looking faithful, and we don't know if you're one of the elect, but you better look the part. And so it might not be a way to authentically live yourself if you begrudgingly participate part way, but it's a very natural transition. I see that so much, but there's an emptiness attached to it that makes me sad for the converse experience, which is seeking in the most devoted, faithful way and in the literature and a network of meaning that your faith has. It should be active and participatory, and you won't always know where you're going to arrive. I feel like if you're going to be faithful in some network of meaning, like a Restoration Era church, and if it's just convenient and socially obligatory enough that you can be unhappy in it and without seeking, then that makes me sad. I mean, there have been times when I have engaged to what seems like a sequential degree in the LDS Church, where I still knew that I was inhabiting my own ideas about the world and about and outside of the Mormon experience. So I was married in an LDS temple at one point, and I don't feel different now than on that day. Even though my life is very secular, I don't have that marriage anymore. My way of viewing that process was as independent to approach that experience as it was to leave some of those practices alone. And so I hope that anybody has the struggle of at least every day I have to figure out what I like. Every day I have to figure out my narrative. We all wake up with these stories. I teach, creative nonfiction. It's part of what my, that's what my background is. And the students that I have who are uncomfortable with writing story based on, events, observation, it's not even their own memoir, but just observing the world and writing nonfiction that is also crafted. That is a sticking point for some until I explain that when you woke up today, you had to craft a narrative about who you are and what you like and how you interact. You have characterized yourself just by waking up, because if not, life is too difficult. And I had an experience, right before I began college as a young adult, where I was in a car accident and I got a brain injury. And the hardest part of that experience was not knowing the narrative of who I was before. When you start to struggle and expand those neural pathways and heal, it's about saying, going out this door will take so many steps that I used to think were conventional. So if you're in a faith community where there are a lot of conventions, a lot of cliche ways to move and think and speak, it doesn't mean that that is wrong. It means that the only way out of it is a new path that expands that previous experience. Going backwards in that same rut is not the same as healing.
No, that makes total sense. I mean, it's a very difficult, painful journey. You've got people on one hand who would say, you know, it's just healthier to just give it up. Let's just completely move beyond. And then on the other side, no, fall back into the ruts. That's where the best place that you could be. And so to chart this own course on your own and define your narrative and who you are and how this all fits, that is no easy task.
Yeah, when you're even bringing it up, actually, when you're asking the question about cafeteria Mormonism, and I'm just trying to even put myself into the thought process of that metaphor, which for me still implies, so let's say, is that you're still going to the cafeteria and maybe you're only picking from this and that thing, but no matter what it is that your portion of the process is simply choosing to accept, you know, like a smaller proportion of the menu that you are being given that is always going to be the same, you know, and your position in that is simply to take, well, I don't want to eat the milk and I'm now a vegan, so I'm not eating this little pizza that you're giving me or whatever it is. And so, but I think so that's completely, I guess, alien to where I am in the restoration and where my choice has been into coming to Community of Christ, which is not to be a cafeteria where I'm keeping this and that little thing, but rather I'm really have to be the cook, you know, and so I am called upon to go in and I am like cooking and that's what I, you know, and I'm making stuff and if people, you know, I like to, part of the job I have is to serve people and feed them and if they like that, then that was wonderful because I've made this wonderful new thing, you know, and so it isn't in any way a cafeteria experience as a result. I'm also wonderful. I love it when other people are making other things and they're sharing that with me. And sometimes they're making stuff I don't like and that's fine. You know, it doesn't mean that they aren't part of the feast here, you know, even if that's not the kind of thing that I want. So
I like that a lot. So instead of cafeteria Mormonism, we have culinary restorationism.
No, that's really good. John is the gourmet chef of the restoration.
So I got a question for you, John. It seems to be a recurring question online. People asking, what's the point to claiming Christ if you don't believe in resurrection literally? Or there's some other, way of wording that, but it's the same basic idea. What's the point to believing if you don't believe in it literally? So would you be willing to share with us why a non-literalistic religion and approach is meaningful in your life?
Right. So yeah, this is a complicated thing to get around, especially when you're coming from the LDS tradition, which is very literalistic and is very concerned with and having all of doctrine and cosmology and everything other thing be being important as actual literal moments in history or something like that. They're events that happen. They are physical things, physical properties. And so if you already have that as a grounding, just even coming up with, like you say, people ask me, okay, when I say that my religion, my faith has nothing to do with anything like that. And so it is a, non-literalistic religion is what I've tried to call it. But, and I've tried to make this argument a couple places where for me, the opposite of literalism is not fiction, which is where I think a lot of people would like to say that it's either literally true or it's a fraud, you know? And that is not the dichotomy that I believe in, because I actually think that if it's literally, that something to, if we're focusing on something just being a literal thing that happens or has happened or anything like that, we are so focused in on an event or a thing or a physical thing that you are talking about a thing that is therefore totally devoid of meaning. Because what's important to you is the thing, the material, the literal, the thing that happened or something like that. And so what happened is it happened. But it therefore is not, and so therefore it can't be having any particular meaning. And I know it's, so that's a complicated, argument to make. But, so even if we were going to have it, let's take it in the cosmology. Let's say that the plan of, the Mormon plan of salvation. So the idea of it is the whole of life and everything like that is that we are gods in embryo at some point or other. The males anyway will have, a partner with whom they are God, and then they'll produce more spirit children and more planets and all this kind of thing. And that is the point of the universe, that there will be a multiplicity of gods and there's more and more and things like that. So the point of the universe is reproduction. So what's the meaning of that still? So in other words, just saying that you have an idea of a thing that's happening literally or something like that doesn't get you to the point of why is that important? Why is that informed the meaning of my life? That to me sounds like simply taking DNA replication and saying that that's cosmologically somehow a thing that is happening universally or something like that. But why is that meaningful? So in other words, the meaning question is still what's really important to me. And so this holds true for any of the things from, a literal conception of resurrection or any other thing. I would rather, focus myself on how does that archetype, how does that theme, how does that narrative inform my actual life? So how many people have I encountered in life who deal with real loss, who deal with loss and pain? And how do you work through the healing cycle of loss, pain, regeneration, recovery? And that powerful actual life cycle, that is the idea and the archetype that is really meaningful. And I don't go around and tell people, well, the literal thing won't happen to you. I mean, that's not within what you know about human life. I mean, we don't know what's beyond, right? So that's fine. People can believe that. I'm not trying to poke people and tell them that, you know, to deflate other people's views on things. But what's meaningful to me is the meaning of that archetype. And that can be true for any number of these other things.
Yeah, absolutely. So we both, Miles and I have a friend named Chris, and, Chris is Episcopalian, and he was attending, a Bible study, and they were looking at the book of Job, and he came home from that, and his, neighbor asked him, oh, so what'd you learn at church? And Chris brought up Job, and the very first thing out of the neighbor's mouth was, well, you know, Job was an actual person, right? As if that's the most important thing that you can take from the book of Job. And that was just so lacking in any meaning or purpose for our friend who's an Episcopalian. He's just like, wait, what? Like,
yeah. Right.
Like he would suddenly be relieved, like, oh, thanks. Oh, I was worried.
Right. Well, thank God Job actually lived.
And all of his children that got killed. Thank heavens that those were real children.
Yeah, exactly.
And that he got new ones up for the whole thing. Because
the story of loss is meaningless.
People, it would be, yeah.
But there's a real fear, and Miles living in Kentucky, in Louisville, close to the Creation Museum, I mean, there is a real fear that if we doubt any part of the scriptural text as being anything other than absolutely literally true, at what point does that stop? The earth has to be created in 6 days. We have these facts about dinosaurs, and so we get these odd, you know, conglomerations of trying to force fact or science into a biblical narrative and demanding that the Bible is the only absolute basis for truth.
And the problem with literalism is that you'd have to apply it to everything. And that's not how we create any meaning. It's packaged and arranged in my world, we have genres and it's not about truth or untruth. And so in creative writing, you know, I studied nonfiction across the street, a bunch of people studied fiction writing and they were all literary genres. And the Latin root of fiction is fictus, to arrange. And so suddenly I'm supposed to not arrange anything, and I'm the literal experience of the world to be writing nonfiction. And that's not the case. We're all crafting the story and the meaning that we like. And I've been just as impacted in my life by a novel as a memoir. And it doesn't matter the percentage of what is rooted in observable experience. And the same way goes for those elevated scriptural texts. How useful is it to have reportage from ancient times? That's not useful. You wouldn't want the weather report from Canaan and, 4,000 years ago, but you somehow want to itemize these literal scriptures, not saying that nothing can be literal, not saying that nothing is not part of the observable experience, but it doesn't need to be. What you're after is story. Story is instructive. Story is impactful. And those are the ways that when I think about rejecting the LDS church or any restoration experience based on core faith tenets, I don't get frustrated on those sticking points very long because it's already here. I'm not one of the collaborators in the 1830s trying to work out that narrative. It already has impacted people. It's irrelevant for me to talk about something being truth or untruth if it's already acting as a motivating part of a society. And after that, then you have to just be your individual inhabiting what's already established. I mean, if you want to go rogue and start your own ideas, then you collaborate and you find that new narrative. But how immersed I've been in the Mormon narrative means that I can't let it go.
So if, to bring things full circle, if you encounter the guy holding the sign in Nauvoo and he says to you, the Book of Mormon is a lie, what do you say? What do you take from the Book of Mormon?
Well, I don't get into polemical arguments with people on the street I have the option to, because I walk around in the city of Toronto and there are evangelicals who want to scream about literal religion and I could get into an argument with them all I want, and I would, there's little techniques that you can do to talk about why in the case of the evangelicals, about why the Bible has obvious contradictions that you could point out that would affect their worldview if they would actually pay attention to them, which they won't. But so for the guy for whom the josephlied.com guy, so if I was like on a train with him and we had to talk and so for a whole long time and we were going to engage in a conversation, I would rather just find out what his story is. So then I would say, well, why is this a, so this is interesting that you're doing this, why is this a motivational thing for you? Then I'd find out if the person themselves is has an ex-Mormon background, or if they have an evangelical background, and then I'd probably want to engage them on either one of their own stories as opposed to the Joseph Smith part of it. And I also, going back to the lady in the who I was telling her, I'm not only concerned about Joseph Smith, I actually wouldn't have confronted her about the Joseph Smith part. I actually would have just talked very glowingly about the heritage part, in other words, so I wouldn't have been confrontational with her about we shouldn't focus so much on Joseph Smith. I would model behavior of not focusing on Joseph Smith. So in same thing what I would have done with this guy. So in terms of the Book of Mormon itself, what do I draw from it? I think that the Book of Mormon has all kinds of wonderful, wonderful insights for us that we have within our heritage that allow us to, because it's new scripture, because it is 19th century scripture, it allows us to see, the Bible in a much different way than, let's say, Protestants or Catholics or other people are able to, because for them, their scripture is so alien to their present day experience, that they are much more liable than where I feel like I am anyway with this, with the insight that I have from the Restoration inheritance. They are much more liable to fall into the trap of scripture worship, where they really are getting to this point where they think the scripture is this alien separate thing, and it isn't have its, all of its own problematic things. So much of scripture is itself pseudepigraphical. It is written centuries after the time it purports to be written in, and all of these kind of things. So it is identical, therefore, to the Book of Mormon, in as much as, so in the same way that the Book of Abraham, let's say, is Joseph Smith telling stories or new stories about Abraham, we have no stories at all about Abraham that are anything other than people centuries after when Abraham would have lived telling new stories about Abraham. That is the entire tradition we have of Abraham. There isn't anything more about Abraham than doing that. So in that way, we have that as a wonderful window into the whole scriptural experience. That doesn't mean that scripture isn't intensely meaningful in all kinds of wonderful ways. It just means that we shouldn't be worshiping it or imagining it as some kind of a literalistic history book. And when we are looking at it that literalistic way, we distort the text. So like the creationist who is putting dinosaurs in their Bible museum, which is crazy because there's no dinosaurs in the Bible. And I mean, all of these ideas that they have about it, in the same exact way, if we make a Book of Mormon museum where they're running around and the swords are sticks with stones on the end of them and they're wearing Mayan clothes and they're riding around on tapirs, they have totally distorted the meaning of the text or the reading of the text. That's not what is in the text. So anyway, you're misreading the text by doing that. So
I still want to go to that museum. That's another thing that you created just through language, and I want it now. Star Trek podcast and a Book of Mormon museum.
Okay, we'll do it.
My response to the Joseph Lied sign and that gentleman or anyone who represents the angst that comes from disbelief or the research of early restoration faith is that I celebrate. I mean, thank God Joseph Lied. That is, if that's the case, it can't be streamlined for me as the only message. Because that's the same as I would have to, if I believed, Joseph Smith only lied, I would be just as apt to believe that he only told the truth. I mean, it's too consolidated for me to think that it has anything to do with the human experience or the divine experience. So I celebrate the noise and the ugliness and the contradictions and the confusion of the beginnings of these restoration faiths. And, it gives me the kind of motivation that somebody might feel that, you know, God loves them and sent his son Jesus Christ to atone for your sins. I take inspiration from humans behaving like human beings and trying to find meaning. And if that also accounts for divine inspiration, if that also accounts for messages that are beyond what's human, I certainly embrace that and hope for that. But it gives me the space to continue if I know that people are making mistakes and yet are being charismatic and creating something that lasts. Because that's all I want to do. And I struggle every day, so why wouldn't somebody who is called a prophet struggle and be a bunch of contradictions too? I celebrate anything that's human and messy, and that's why I like the 19th century, not the 20th century for Mormonism.
Well, I want to thank both of you. I mean, I think this has been an incredible conversation. It's one that I wish I had heard 10 years ago, because I really think there is the potential for a healthy way to approach doubt and wrestling with one's faith. rather than just going to the extremes. And so I appreciate your comments, and let's give them a round of applause. Now, does anybody have a question? We got a little bit of time. I'm happy to take questions from the audience if anybody has a question.
Oh, that hurts.
Well, let me ask you a question, John. So John DeLynn has called you Vulcan. He's called you Spock, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So what's your very favorite Star Trek episode?
Oh, it's not even, this is not a, one that's not on the list, so it's already one of the most popular ones, but my favorite one is the Next Generation episode, The Inner Light, which is the one where Picard lives this whole other life. And the reason why I love that is that there's something inside of me that, when I just see the thing where where you have the person's entire life cycle, you know, where they grow, they age, they get older, and they die. Like the ending of, 6 Feet Under, like the finale episode. I don't want to give it away for people, but they go through the life cycle and I'm just bawling, you know, and through that whole thing that just makes me, that episode I just love too, because I like just thinking about, life in big perspective like that. And I find a lot of, it resonates with me.
So that emotional attachment is very un-Vulcan-like.
That's right.
Question from the audience, from Robin Linkhart, our pastor here in Salt Lake. So Robin asks, looking at Joseph's eccentricities as well as his failures, what specific behaviors does Miles find meaningful or relevant?
Well, directly, it's the struggle to find language and to create a story. When you got somebody who is uneducated and then moves through a life that creates literacy and creates not just through public speaking but some sort of written lasting word, I am so moved to this day about that struggle of saying, I still want to create the words. I still want to, at some point it becomes about maintaining and reducing and destroying the language that's already there so that you can streamline the narrative. But in the beginning, it's really creative, and that can often be the sticking point for a lot of people to resist the story of Joseph Smith. But for me, because if you looked in my computer of all the pieces of writing that I began, I wouldn't want to own up to all of them. But I need all of those in order to create the pieces that do work. And I think that the fact that it becomes so much authority so fast in the Joseph Smith story, that the language that he's creating and public speaking and his interpersonal relationships and his foundation of a faith and it's written scripture, that's where there's more at stake. I can see why people being frustrated with invention when there's so much on the line, in the immediate future, not necessarily the hereafter, just so much on the line. But as far as if I think about him as struggling to find the words, that's what I do. And I really like that eccentricity. I think too many parts about the personal life and impulses I don't relate to, but I also all of my experiences don't show up in my writing. And what we have most solidly from Joseph Smith is this lasting literature. So that's how I try to view him.
And as you were putting that all together, I was struck by the fact that some detractors will say that Joseph Smith, or point out that Joseph Smith, did not use the Book of Mormon, especially the later period of his life. And it almost seems like to me, hearing what you're saying, Miles, that it's not that he didn't believe in the Book of Mormon, but he believed in the power of creating narrative. And so that was what he was doing. And so to go back doesn't make sense. He was always weaving a new narrative and presenting new ideas.
And also the story, the context of how it originates. I mean, the translations that aren't translations and the magical artifacts that create those stories. I love that too. I mean, it's so, I wish I could, you know, go back and say that it wasn't, just tear-filled nights that created my writing. You know, I wish that I had some more, imaginative origin stories. So I don't actually hold that against him either.
So the question from Monica here in the audience, mentioning that it's been stated that fiction, looking at fiction is nonfiction. So specifically, what in your lives, what fiction have you found meaningful?
Well, you said that. You found fiction as meaningful as nonfiction. I actually am not a huge reader of fiction. I'm actually a huge reader of history, but there is a whole huge portion of history and historical documents and everything like that that aren't actual history, you know. And so, but so for me, actually, the difference for me is not the difference between reading stories from history versus reading fiction now and being inspired by fiction now, but rather the ideas, you know, coming up with the ideas themselves. So one of the things that is the alternate. For example, philosophy. So what people in antiquity, the ideas that they're proposing behind these stories, why are we telling this story, which is not, you know, if we're talking about like the Old Testament stories, they're largely not history in any way. So why is the author, you know, telling, you know, this story, and in many cases it's an oral tradition. So why is that story told? What is the idea behind it? What is the meaning for all of that? And so for me, it is I'm interested in those ideas. I'm interested in, reading philosophy, theology, reading story in that way. So, but I'm odd in that I actually haven't read a lot of literature. So
that's okay. It's a lot safer to be stay away from the noise of literature. Probably first moved by work of fiction that kind of carried through teaching, writing, and thinking about it is there's a Edgar Allan Poe novel called The Narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym, and it pretends to be a sea captain's narrative because that was the best-selling work at the time. In the 1850s, the only way you could get a book contract was to say, I was a captain, I saw some weird stuff. So, and then you write about it in as sensational a way as possible, and people are, you know, there's an island where people are carrying around their heads around their waists, and, you know, there's just nonsense, right? And they would make them as sensational as possible. So he wrote a novel that was flawed and ridiculous, like a memoir. And the parts in it that are the most truthful are... the sounds of birds are written out as a play that his mother was in before she died, or the dog is his brother, or there are all these kinds of embedded personal truths in this just a fun adventure novel, basically. They just go out to sea and try not to die. And that has always been meaningful to me, in that just because something's crafted or engineered for your digestion, just because you're going to go on this adventure with somebody with the story, doesn't mean that the most poignant and direct experiences of that creator's life aren't there with you. You don't have to recognize it for it to still move you. And that's how I see scripture, and that's how I see the narratives of my family members and friends who have participated in what I think Mormonism is that there's a very distinctive personal experience that creates that wider story. And you might not perceive all of those, but it's there even if the story is uniform. And that's why I still kind of hang on to I'm a Mormon.
So we have three more questions, and rather than having me act as a filter, I'm just going to have you come up. Tell us your name and talk right into the mic here.
Hi, my name's Skip Reinierson. And first of all, Miles, I wanted to tell you that I don't know if you've read it or if you've heard about it, but there's a what I thought was a really good article in the City Weekly written by a guy by the name of Mike Furness. It's called The Mormon Masterpiece, and a lot of your comments tonight made me recall it because it talks about Joseph Smith as an artist, as a conceptual artist, and as, you know, the different media that, you know, he developed his art through. And it's kind of an interesting perspective. It deals less with the question that you guys have talked about tonight of, you know, whether or not it's true. But, you know, what was the product? And, you know, is it something beautiful? Is it something worth observing? And so I just wanted to make mention of that. Now I have a question for John. John, you and I had corresponded one time online, and I had mentioned that, since leaving the LDS Church, I've found a home in the Unitarian Universalist Church. And, not to put you on the spot in a community of Christ Church, you know, or given that that's the faith you're a pastor in, but, what made you choose Community of Christ over, like, Unitarian Universalism, given, you know, your beliefs as you've explained them? And also, if you could try to tackle the question of, what would you see as an ideal scenario for somebody to choose Community of Christ over Unitarian Universalism?
To begin with, I would say the Unitarian Universalist tradition is a magnificent tradition, and so everybody who finds themselves in a Unitarian congregation and finds that as a spiritual home or finds fellowship there, I applaud, and I just think that that's wonderful, and I think that I very easily could have gone that direction, and that could have easily have been. I totally believe in converting and going all into new things. I am a convert to Canada, you know, and I'm gonna stay there for the rest of my life. I'm committed to Canada. This is my place, and I'm living in downtown Toronto, and I'm setting all my roots down there. And you would have every reason, just for the magnificent past and traditions that the Unitarians have to draw upon. So, for example, you know, just the being the real pioneers in the, you know, fight against slavery and every other thing to be proud of in that tradition. And so I also think that it's important institutions like the Unitarian Universalist Church and also Community of Christ, I think, are critically important right now in where we are in the 21st century to provide, you know, very, very positive, wonderful, progressive alternatives for people who are seeking a faith tradition. And let's say they just want to raise their kids. They haven't been churched for a whole long time. They get to a certain age as a couple. They have a couple kids. They think, well, maybe it'd be good to have my kids grow up in some church, and they go down the street to a mega church that is more or less like a big shopping mall that is filled with all the games and things that their kids might do, and it's a lot of fun. But then it turns out that the messages and the political and social messages, the sexism, anti-gay messages, all these kind of things end up being really quite, you know, detrimental, and it affects their society. And so if we abdicate and creating alternatives for people, you know, to be able to go to, then how can we blame them for that's where they ended up, right? So I think we should be very supportive of each other in terms of the two denominations. And I think we are. I know that the Community of Christ here in Salt Lake has a great relationship with the Salt Lake Unitarian Church. And same thing, we're very ecumenical. So why did I pick Community of Christ over the Unitarians myself. So for myself, I am a convert to Community of Christ. I am a seventh generation member of the Latter-day Saint tradition. This is in my blood. I know an awful lot about the tradition. I've studied it a lot. I actually enjoy it. I'm not particularly focused on Joseph Smith, but I do like the rest of it. I mean, I do like the idea of all getting together and making community. I like going to Nauvoo and seeing just the idea that we're all going to get together and build something. We're going to build Zion together. I think that it's an inspiring tradition in that way. And then I also think that in that same way that I talked about being able to provide this important social alternative in the entire world, that also within the Restoration tradition, for people to have an alternative, a progressive alternative within their own heritage, is so critically important that I feel called to devote my entire life to building that path, and intend to devote my entire life to doing that. So that's why.
So there seems to be a common theme tonight about literalist and non-literalist belief, and it's fair to say that you're both in the camp of non-literalist belief pretty firmly. And I just thought back to the example of Job. I think Seth had a friend that was talking about Job and saying it's important that you know that he's a literal person. And both of you think, well, why are you investing in that, right? That's silly that you're investing in that. But I would say that from their perspective, they don't have the resources to invest in the kind of non-literalist belief that you two value. In other words, if I believe literally that there is a God, he is real, and the story of Job is literally true, then I don't have the resources to go into a non-literalist realm. I can't find the meaning that you have, because what it means to me is I can walk down the street and God can have the devil run a car into me capriciously or on a bet. So you see what I'm saying? So that's where all his resources are going. So it makes it tough to go into this other realm, because all your time is spent there. And I know people that are very literal, especially in this city, they're very literal. So all their time is spent there. So they can say, that's great that you're pulling an allegory from this, and that's really neat, and you can apply that in your life in different ways, and you can relate it to literature. For them, it's like, I got enough on my plate right now, because this has dire consequences to my life. So I'm in the non-literalist camp too, but I also understand where they're coming from, because the consequences are potentially so catastrophic. So.
No, yeah. I completely agree with you that it isn't necessarily the thing that people immediately jump to or are equipped to jump to. And especially, like you say, when it's been painted that way, and that's what they're where the focus has been. And, Community of Christ didn't just emerge fully formed as, in this kind of perfect system where everybody is, out in the future land of perfection in terms of all of their thinking on everything. And so it's not like we don't have people who have struggled with this and who are all over the place. And in my own congregation, I have a lot of members who are very, literal historicists about the Book of Mormon and all this kind of thing. And they would feel the same way about Job. Or the Tower of Babel, maybe even, I don't know. And so anyway, we're just where they're at. But despite the fact that they may well be coming from it from that perspective, it doesn't mean that you can't, they aren't equipped to talk about the meaning of the story. I think that they actually are very equipped to do that. And I have an experience of that, because I actually teach adult Sunday school, every Sunday. And my congregation, and we're on Old Testament, and we are just reading through, the Old Testament. And right now we're reading the book of Judges, which is just filled with just horrible stories. If you're taking them all literally, I mean, Samson is ripping people's arms off and all the different kinds of things that happen. So in the middle, or let's say going to Job. So the question that everybody can understand in that is, the question that's being asked here is what, is the problem of evil? Why do righteous people suffer? Why have I experienced this kind of suffering in my life? Why, when I haven't felt like I had done this or that wrong, or I've known someone who is like Job of the story, completely without blame, and yet these horrible things have happened to me? And so even though it's a simple answer is to have heard and preached the prosperity gospel. If you do this and this and that and what, you'll be blessed and you'll become rich and you'll have a fancy car and all those kind of things. Even though that's the, perhaps what the simple, answer that we'd like to have be the case, it turns out that the problem of evil is actually, you know, seriously more complicated than that. And the book of Job, itself, in confronting this problem, itself has multiple attempted answers, which it in some ways isn't able to resolve all by itself. And so I do think that when we read that and when we read those things together, we can, the thing I always do is after we read a section, then I ask, what do you think of this proposition? What do you think about, suffering being caused, having this cause? What has been your experience of suffering in your life? And people, no matter where they're coming from, are able to, relate and how tell their own stories, their own experiences, how they feel, what they feel meaning is, where they've experienced meaning. And we accomplish that every week. It's a wonderful discussion. And, you know, it doesn't require that everybody's, you know, gone to graduate school to have it, you know, so.
And for my part, not being a literalist, just because I like the Bhagavad Gita doesn't mean that I don't understand why there are tens of thousands of different idols and altars in different villages. I am in discomfort most of the time. I am not happy, but the inquiry is satisfying to me. And the instability of meaning is satisfying to me. If that's not a place that people want to inhabit, that's what I think is available in restoration churches or any other space where meaning can get created, is that what's authentic to you, you might need the literal interpretation. You might need that figurine to pray to. I don't privilege the way I do things over it. How someone else approaches it. I only think that it's available within the tradition of Mormonism to not be literal. I think it's a possibility that I've taken in order to inhabit my own body and live through the world. And I can totally value how somebody needs to say, look, I can't do this without the story being ratcheted into this spot. And I value that. The only way it causes a problem is if that literal interpretation keeps you from loving other people, keeps you from loving yourself. I mean, that sounds really sentimental, and I'm full of schmaltz. But but if it's not getting in the way, then it is a tool. And same way, I've maybe been evasive in saying that I don't believe in literal interpretations, and that's the tool I use to survive.
My name's Tammy, and my question is for both of you. I went to reunion recently, and that was a new experience for me. Community of Christ is very new to me. And one day our topic of discussion was Zion. And so I, of course, have a very different, from growing up LDS, I have a very different notion of what Zion is than anything that seemed to be there in the class or the workshop that I went to at reunion. So I wondered if you could, this being a Project Zion podcast, tell me what each of you understand by the meaning of the word Zion.
So Zion has a deep tradition, obviously, within the entire Restoration, and there has been a little bit of a divergence in emphasis between reorganized tradition and the Utah tradition about what building Zion has continued to be about. So in the early church, there was an idea of building Zion and actually making the city that you're all going to inhabit together. And it was also very apocalyptic. So they really felt that the end of the world was also going to happen very literally, very soon after they quickly did that. But one of the things that they took, though, at the early times as their model was doing some kind of experiment of living together, sharing property. It's often described, we tend to try to describe all of those as being horrible failures because we don't like to admit that sometimes it worked kind of because it's scary to the idea. Nobody really wants to have to be called upon to share property, right? It's the hardest thing in all of, in the entire Christian tradition, to even be thinking about. But so how do you build it? So for Community of Christ, the word Zion had continued to be really, really, really powerful and it got reinterpreted several ways. So Zionic became a adjective in Community of Christ. And so everything is a Zionic mission. And there was a lot of talk of how to be Zionic. In the early 20th century, it got connected up with the idea of the social gospel. So again, how do we all build, how do we build together by helping, poorer members of the society so that they can be empowered so that we can all build, you know, a just society together. And that has continued to evolve forward. And so, where I'd say I'm at now with the idea of Zion is that as opposed to, being inspired by Zion in a literal apocalyptic sense, as if, the millennium would just around the corner like it always has been, instead of believing in a literal millennium where the whole world would get destroyed and all this kind of thing, I tend to be the other focus that has existed in the Christian tradition the entire time, which is the kingdom is here among us. It's at hand. You can't look for it in the sky because you won't see it. You know, it's here when we all, are acting, you know, thoughtfully together, if when we are all building a signal community. So even naming our church, when we rename the church Community of Christ, the word community there in some ways is Zion. That's the Zionic ideal that is right there embedded in the heart of the Restoration. We want to get together to build community for the purposes of improving society in the ways that I talked about, you know, like at the world at large, within the Restoration tradition, within our own communities. So all of our mission initiatives, all of our mission is about how are we together as a community, building a peaceable kingdom, building justice, enjoying blessings of community together, continually learning and growing together. And it's both inward for our own congregation as we're trying to learn more, but it's also outward. What are we doing in the community around us? So, for example, like I've mentioned before, our congregation has is actively engaged in providing social housing in the downtown, which is a very serious issue in any city. So, in other words, whatever it is that we feel that you feel called upon to do to try to build Zion right here and now.
For me, in the LDS tradition, I love it as an adjective. I love Zionic as a way of talking about a process and a goal that is continual. And in the LDS tradition, there is a separate, apocalyptic version of Zion, but, the way that it mostly functions is right where we are. This valley is the Zion. This is the point of arrival. And whether it's prophetic foresight, or an accidental point of arrival under duress, this Zion, I really take to heart because to me, the concept of Zion is inhabiting an inhospitable place. And that's a lot of our experience just being alive. But this particular space, the Salt Lake Valley, was not permanently inhabited by any human beings before the Mormons, burned bridges enough to arrive here. So, I love the idea that even indigenous nations did not want to live here because it's such a piece of garbage. It's a really awful space. And it's been made, I mean, it's basically like, it was like a big cat's litter box when they arrived. It was disgusting and it traps smoke even before industrialized cities. There's the only lake that's not life-giving in the country. There are so many problematic spots to this place that I think that it follows everything problematic about the Mormon traditions that I love. And this is beautifying only to a point still, but beautifying an ugly space. And that's Zion to me, is that the metaphor is built into the physical point of arrival for the LDS Church, is that this creating your Vatican out of a place that nobody wants takes a lot of risk and is something that I think is just waking up and being alive, is that I'm really uncomfortable and I'm going to beautify this. I'm going to take what's ugly and make it beautiful.
All right, well, thanks again to both of you. Let's give them another round of applause.
Is sponsored by the Latter-day Seekers team from Community of Christ. The views expressed in this podcast are the opinions of those speaking and do not necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or official stance of Community of Christ or the Latter-day Seekers team.